Welcome to the Wise Women Diaries podcast. This is where shame and victimhood die. I am a woman that questions everything, so this podcast is a reflection of that. Here we speak on non-mainstream perspectives, like healing our childhood wounds, learning to trust ourselves, the voice of fear versus intuition, and how children are our teachers. We discuss what it looks like to own your power as a woman and step out of the medical paradigm. That's why I am obsessed with interviewing women who trust their bodies and babies in home birth and free birth, and their wild journey from maiden to mother. Ultimately, this podcast is for women who want to thrive and have inner peace, learning how to take radical responsibility for their life and shed victimhood for good.
Hi, my name is Katie, and I am born and raised in Cincinnati, Ohio. And then I went to Ohio State University and eventually to a really small school called Denison, just outside of Columbus. But I studied abroad in Australia in 2012. In my second to last year of college. And that was how I came to be here and how I met all of my friends and my now husband through a series of visas and international student programs and whatever. Yeah, now I'm a citizen. So I feel like an international man of mystery with my dual passports. But I guess my story really, I think, would focus around my like matrescence or becoming a mother, because that was really what triggered a lot of my forced analysis of my childhood, which I had been actively trying to escape from, emotionally dissociating through drug use and then obviously physically distancing myself. And I think until I had that distance, I couldn't even begin to examine it because it was just too raw. And then being over here gave me that space to do that. And then being a mother kind of just really forced the like laser focus onto what sort of person do you want to be? Have you danced with all of your demons? Are you ready to help someone else become an adult eventually? A happy, well-adjusted adult. My birth mother is from New York City. She moved to Ohio with her then girlfriend when she was in her mid-20s. She had a difficult time conceiving. She talked a lot about how she had several miscarriages before she had me. And I don't know if it's a narcissist thing or if it was just her, but I was only purely ever just an extension of her. So everything she experienced was, you will experience this. This is what is going to happen to you, which is difficult because it's obviously not true, but then even more difficult because obviously she was a lesbian and I knew from a young age that I was attracted to men. And so there was this element of, well, but I won't experience this the way that you are because I will have a husband and my children will have a father. And there was always kind of this like low-key disparaging talk around straight women and the relationship that they had with their children. Like they would say weird things, her and her partner, of like, you know, oh, straight women are really weird with their sons. They, you know, they're kind of in love with them and they're very possessive of them. Or, oh, straight women are really weird with their daughters. They hypersexualize them to cater to the male gaze. And there was a lot of, you know, being very gender neutral and not having this like typical feminine portrayal of myself, which was actually really annoying because I wanted to wear dresses and paint my nails and get my ears pierced. And that was all very, no, you don't actually want to do that. That's just society and men trying to tell you that you need to do that to be appealing. And I was like, I'm 7. I just want pink fingernails, you know, it's pretty heavy putting all this on me. So yeah, anyways, I digress. From a very early age, I knew I was donor conceived and I didn't know anything at all about my donor. I knew the hospital, I think, or the clinic, the university clinic that my mom was artificially inseminated at. And that was it. There was just a very active attempt to completely write him out of my genetic identity altogether. It was like, she would say she quote unquote hatched me from an egg, you know, like I was just all hers, completely hers. And again, it could be a narcissist thing, could just be something that women who identify as single moms by choice kind of say because they're the only one there making the decisions. And anyways, so my parents actually ended up getting separated when I was 3. And I don't mean to be like, make sweeping generalizations, but in my experience, from everything I've seen of lesbian couples, they do tend to couple up very quickly, like within a week or two, you know, they're moving in together. And that was exactly what happened with me. My parents divorced, they weren't married. It was Ohio in the 90s. but they separated, and then almost immediately, like within a couple weeks, we were moved into her new girlfriend's house. That woman had been with another woman for like 30 years. She was out. Like, it was just boom, boom, boom. And then all of a sudden I had 4 moms. And on my first day of first grade, I remember going into school with all 4 of my moms behind me in, you know, Ohio. and just, I had like my hair hanging in front of my face for the photo. Cause I was just, I was so embarrassed, you know, I was so wildly different from everyone. And there it was for them, all the little kids to see. And I remember kids teasing me, being like, oh, Katie has AIDS at like such a young age too. Like their parents would tell them, well, her parents are gay, they must have AIDS. And little girls' moms would be afraid to let them come over to my house in case I would like make a pass at them or, yeah, which obviously I was not, yeah. I was, if anything, boy crazy from a very young age. Like I would chase little boys around the schoolyard and pin them up against the fence and be like, I think you're cute, and run away, much to my parents' dismay. Yeah, there was kind of always that tension growing up of like, I knew I was straight. I knew I wanted a radically different family than what was being presented to me. I didn't necessarily dislike it. Like it was fine having moms, but I did want a dad. I would see little girls with their dads, and you know, Father's Day would come around and my mom would be like, make something for your grandpa. And I'd be like, you make something for your grandpa. I have to do 4 times the work on Mother's Day. This is my day off. I remember I got in trouble at school because I like put my feet up on my desk, hands behind my head, and was like, I'm not doing this card for Father's Day. Like you guys can all get stuffed. It's not my problem. But yeah, so anyways, fast forward to when I'm 18, and I guess I'll have to tell you names because it gets a bit confusing. My birth mother's name is Leanne, and the woman that she got with when I was 3 is named Susan. The woman she was originally with when I was born is named Beth, and then Beth's partner that she got with when I was 3 is named Lisa. So anyways, Leanne and Beth were the original 2, and when I turned 18, after years and years of battles of you owe me this much child support, you only get to see her this many days a week, why are you wearing this outfit there? If anyone listening has ever had divorced parents, they can insert trauma here. It was exactly as terrible as everyone ever says it is. And then when I turned 18, I think Beth was finally so happy to not have that constant dangling legal threat of like, well, I'm not actually your parent and she could take you from me at a moment's notice because second parent adoption was illegal. They were never legally married. Beth wasn't my biological mother by any measure. And so it was a constant threat from Leanne of, if you step one toe out of line, if you don't give me everything I want, she's gone. You'll never see her. And I felt obviously very much like a pawn in that situation too, because it was kind of, it colored every relationship, every moment I had with Beth of her kind of underlying desperation to be like, this is it. This is my 2 hours with you this week, you know, like just the, and I think I kind of relate to adopted people in a way because it's like now she is who I call mom. And she is, in fact, her and Lisa are the only 2 I speak to. And I feel like, the other day I had this thought, this is a very random aside, but if you look at the fabric of humanity and you imagine that everyone has a thread going back through the generations to their ancestors, I feel like with adoption, for lack of a better word, you're picking up someone else's thread. And it's hard to feel like you belong. You definitely get imposter syndrome, especially because I did have cousins on that side that were part of that family. And so you would hear the stories about, oh, great grandpa Fritz or great grandma Harriet. And, you know, it was like, well, but they're not mine. It's not really my identity. I don't really look like them. I'm not actually that. My whole family was Jewish as well. And so it's like, I'm not actually Jewish. You know, I don't look Jewish. I go to temple. I get teased and called AJ, the Aryan Jew, because I have straight blonde hair and blue eyes. But then I was told, but you are, we're raising you Jewish. You're part of this family. I had my bat mitzvah. I was a Hebrew school teacher. I was very involved in the temple, but I always felt like I didn't belong. And now I'm not practicing. It's pretty hard to find any Jews over here in Australia anyways, but that's another issue entirely. So I just kind of always felt like I had picked up someone else's thread and was running with it. And at the same time, not knowing my donor felt very odd because I was carrying someone else's thread. I didn't know what it was, you know? And so it's just kind of this like displacement, I guess is the best way to put it. And so it's not for lack of anything on Beth's family's side. They always treated me like I was their grandchild and that was that. But it's just an internal feeling of like, oh, I don't really belong. And that hurts. Like, that's very sad. So anyways, when I turned 18, Beth had had years of hatred and fighting with Leanne. To give a little bit of context to who Leanne is, she's herself comes from a very horrible childhood. Her mother abandoned her when she was four. She was horrifically beaten, you know, in, I think she was in Long Island or Staten Island or one of, back then, a not good suburb of New York, and just incredibly crass and vulgar and violent, very, very violent. There was a lot of verbal and physical abuse, a lot of altercations. I actually ended up leaving the house when I was a teenager because I just couldn't stay. And she's a horrible drunk and a narcissist. She's also a lawyer and does really well in her work. So it's a weird juxtaposition of like the really high success and then just the absolute depravity of who she is. So anyway, she's a difficult person to say the least. And when I turned 18, Beth was like, finally, you know, the threats of losing you are over. I can finally tell you the truth about who this woman is, turn you against her, and we can be family. Unfortunately, I wasn't ready to hear that truth. So essentially what she told me was, everything you've ever been told about your conception is a lie. You're not donor conceived. Your mother was assaulted by her boss. It was kind of like consensual in the sense of like, she wanted a baby and he was like harassing her for ages. And so she just kind of like let it happen, but like, it wasn't what she wanted. I don't know. To be honest, when I was hearing the story, I was having such an intense emotional reaction to it. I'm not 100% sure I have the details spot on, but it was traumatizing for sure. And I didn't really know how to take that on board. And I had just started smoking a fair bit of weed at the time. And that I just went off a cliff. I started smoking all day, every day. I guess what you could say, a high functioning drug user. I always continued to excel at my classes, always had, you know, work and kept myself together and, you know, had my friends and was social and whatever. But that was, I was just constantly dissociating, like morning to night, 24/7. So that was really hard to hear that story because I always, from a little kid, wished that I had been conceived, not even out of love or heat of the moment or whatever, but just even out of like serendipitous circumstance, you know, at least these two people came together for this one moment. And it's like, well, no, they didn't, you know, but then later finding out, oh, they did actually, but it was horrible. And it's like, whoa, I don't know what the truth is. I have taken a DNA test, and it's inconclusive. I haven't found like a huge pod of siblings, which would have been, you know, if I was donor conceived, probably the case. But I haven't exactly found like someone who meets the description of what I expect her boss's family might have been like, if that makes sense. So I don't know. I'm in my heart, I'm like, I was probably just donor conceived, but who could say? Years later, when I did confront my mom about this, she didn't deny it. And she was just like, yes, it did happen, but I'm pretty sure that because I was getting the artificial insemination treatments at the same time, I'm pretty sure that you were actually the artificial insemination baby. And I was just like, okay, fair enough. I'll just go with that. I can't deal with this right now. So anyways, when Beth told me that, I actually stopped talking to her. Like, I completely cut her off for about 10 years because it was just like, how could you do this to me? How could you say this? Like, what sort of lie have I been living? What other secrets have you been harboring? And just in general, like, I stopped talking to pretty much all of my family for a long time because I was just like, this is too much. This is too much. I'm in my 20s. I need to figure my stuff out. I always had a very stable relationship. Like, I had a boyfriend for, you know, a couple years here and there. And so it wasn't like I was throwing myself out there and sleeping around and trying to find myself that way. But I was definitely trying to like lose myself in my imagination of what my new family was going to be like and less about my past. Anyways, I came over here because my best friend at university was studying abroad and I didn't want to be alone at the university without her. So she went to England and I was like, oh, I guess I'll just go to Australia because it's very far away and why not? And when I was here, I ended up meeting my now husband. We were just friends through school and then we ended up living in the same share house and we started dating in 2016 or 15 and got married in 2017. And have been together happily ever since. And he's a wonderful man. And I owe him a lot of explaining to me the steps I needed to take to start to reconcile with my history. And so he actually helped me get back in touch with Beth and Lisa, which has been one of the best things I've ever done. They are the grandparents to my children. We have a very healthy relationship. You know, they're very kind and loving. We respect each other's boundaries. We are able to talk about the past in the ways that needs to put it to bed, but we don't reminisce too much. There's a quote from a therapist that I quite like that's like, people say, stop living in the past, but you can't help it because the past is still alive within you. And this is my like crazy theory. That I think time isn't linear. I think it's, you know, circular or it's happening all at once, so to speak, but we can only comprehend it linearly. And there were so many times when I was a little girl that I was, you know, fresh out of a beating or fresh out of a fight or whatever. And I would just sit there on my bed crying. And I remember holding my own hand and being like, you're okay. You're going to get out of this. You know, imagine that the 30-year-old version of you has come back, sat down and is holding your hand and I'm going to get you through this. You're going to live. You're going to survive. She's not going to kill you and you'll be okay. And so now I almost feel like as that happy, healed, healthy 30-year-old, I almost go back and visit the 10, 9, 8, 7-year-old and hold her hand and go like, you did it. You're here. You know, we saved ourselves. No one came. There was no knight in shining armor. I mean, there was, you know, my husband, but like, you did it. So it's not negative for me to revisit those feelings so much anymore. It's helpful in a way. But yeah, so Joe got me back in touch with Beth and Lisa, and that was great. And I think everything for me really came to a head with the birth of my first child in terms of like the matrescence thing. So it was it was the end of 2019. And over here, obviously, our seasons are reversed. So it was December. It was just starting to get warm. We're getting into summer. Very exciting. Can't wait to go out and do stuff. And then all those horrible bushfires happened. Then COVID hit. And then I lost my job because I was a dental assistant. And COVID, you know, people's mouths, we weren't operating as we were. And then I found out I was pregnant. And then we moved to the other side of the city. So I lost like everything I had been doing. My whole routine was just completely thrown out. And while I was pregnant, I had far too much time locked in my house on my phone. And I started scrolling Instagram. And I think Instagram knew I was pregnant before I knew I was pregnant because it started giving me all this breastfeeding advice and all these baby reels. And I was like, what is this? And there is a midwife over here named Dr. Robin Thompson. And she has a course on breastfeeding that I did online. And just one little, it's like a series of videos. And one of the videos was about the interventions in labor. And it was a cascade of interventions and how if you start with induction, you'll probably end up with a cesarean. And I was like, oh, that's very interesting, because I remember my mom telling me, you know, she got induced and everything she told me when she, because I was actually talking to her at this point again. And she was like, oh, you know, you're going to have a boy. I'm certain it's a boy. A psychic told me years ago that you're going to have three boys. So like in her mind, she had figured my whole pregnancy out. I was having a son. I was going to be induced. I was going to need an epidural. It was going to be hard and horrible and blah, 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 blah. And I was like, I don't think so. And then when I got my scan and it was like, oh, it's a little girl, I felt like, aha, I can write my own story now. It's not what you said. See, it's not a little boy. It's not going to be that way. And I was versed on the cascade of interventions, and I was really, really against having anything done. So they kind of were, you know, coming up with reasons. Oh, your fluid levels are low. And then my husband is incredibly intelligent and incredibly quick at research. And he's like, well, here's six studies out of the UK, France, and Germany saying that they're within the appropriate fluid levels and you don't need this and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, you know what? I'm just going to trust my body can do this. Like, I'm not going to worry about it. I had, from a young age, I had been told to go on birth control, never gone on it. I was just very averse to Western medicine from like a really young age for no good reason. Maybe now that I think about it, I was just averse to the authority that doctors wanted to have over me, because I was already under the oppressive thumb of my mother. And I was like, I will be damned if someone else has any other measure of control in my life. That's it. I'm done. So yeah, I had Rachel, but because it was COVID, I did still have her in the hospital, but I was a terrible patient. I was like ripping all the monitors off me, getting in the shower. They're like, you can't get in the shower. Our PPE doesn't work if it gets wet. And I'm like, well, everything inside my body is wet, so I don't believe you, because everything that's about to come out here is going to be soaking wet. So don't tell me that your little gloves don't work because I took a shower. And I did end up getting morphine with her, because it was like a really long, like 18-hour labor, because I went to the hospital, was sent home, went back to the hospital, was sent home. And actually, by the time I told them I was ready to push, they were like, no, you're not. You were just 2 centimeters like half an hour ago. And I was like, no, I'm pushing. And she came out. So yeah, I was very lucky to not, I'm terrified of needles. I was not going to get the epidural no matter how much pain I was in. But it went overall well. There was just a bit of like back and forth fighting of like, you know, oh, your waters have been ruptured for this long, now you need antibiotics and blah, blah, blah. And my husband being like, no, she doesn't want them. She doesn't need them. And just that stress of him having to be my advocate, and also the ticking clock of COVID of being like, after so many hours, you're going to have to leave because our hospital has these rules. Melbourne, particularly, out of any city in the world, had the most days in lockdown. We were trapped in our houses, 5-kilometer radiuses. The National Guard drove up and down the street to make sure that no one was leaving when they weren't meant to be. I was really feeling like, communist, yes, this is decidedly unfree. It was the only time I've ever been like, I would go back to America. Yeah.
How many months were you under strict orders like that in COVID?
I think all up, it was actually over a year. Yeah, in bits and pieces, in like 5-month block, 7-month block. It was a lot.
That's crazy, because I'm in Arizona and we had nothing. We had no restrictions at all. We could eat at a restaurant that whole time, maybe besides 2 months. Like, our entire normal life was normal. That's wild.
Yeah, we all had like really intense lockdowns, to the extent of like, Joe and I were just saying the other day, we have COVID amnesia, where it's like, what did we do for those years? Like, I know we had a newborn for one of them, but I don't remember. I look at the photos and I'm like, yeah.
Wait, so what year did you have Rachel?
She was born in November of 2020. So I got pregnant in March of 2020, right as everything kind of kicked off. Yeah, so anyways, it was okay. Like, I actually, after giving birth, wrote a letter to the hospital, like, thanks so much, guys. This was wonderful. Cause I was just on that postpartum high of like, haha, I did it. But when I fell pregnant with Charlie, I was like, you know, I really want to just have him at home. Like, we moved out to the country. We lived that much further away from the hospital. I knew the ride to the hospital was going to be agony. And I was like, I really just want to have him at home, because I had what was considered a precipitous labor with Rachel. And I just had this feeling he was going to come so fast. And Joe was like, yeah, let's hire a private midwife. Let's do it. Like, if you think you can do it, you're driving this car. I don't care. So we did, and it was lovely having the private midwife, just the little pool in the lounge room. Rachel got to be a part of it. Well, sort of. I went into labor at 2 a.m. He was born at 6 a.m. Rachel woke up at like 10 to 6. So she got to be a part of it literally right as I was pushing. Like, she just came out and was like, you know, oh, baby brother. Whoa, good morning. and my mom, Beth, had flown over as well. And it was really funny because, like, having my mom be a woman who has never been pregnant, has never really been around baby world, like, definitely didn't raise kids full time. It was very, like, she was like, like, very nervous about it. But she was good. It was fine. But it was just funny because it was like, this is not your scene. I get it. And yeah, so had Charlie, no worries, like no pain medication. I mean, the pool was enough. It was great, like just being in the pool. And I didn't even make it through Garden State. I put it on and didn't finish the movie and he was born. But yeah, so to kind of go backwards in time a little bit, when Rachel was about one was kind of when I realized I had to stop talking to my birth mother altogether, because when I got pregnant, her and Susan, the woman she had been with since I was three, separated. Susan cheated on her with some other lesbian down the street from them. They had moved to the East Coast by then, because I think there were no more lesbians left in Ohio. You know, they had to go further afield. So she cheated and my mom just went off the rails. She started being like, you know, oh, now I can finally live for myself. And like, her drinking got incredibly out of hand and she was going out with her new friends all the time. And like, never once did her or Susan pay attention to the time difference or anything like that. And they only ever called me when they needed something. So she would call me at like 2-3 o'clock in the morning, drunk and, you know, crying, be like, I'm sorry, I was such a terrible mother and I need this and my mother never loved me and blah, blah. And it was just like, I cannot deal with your shit right now. I have a tiny little baby. You don't care about her. You've never wanted to have like a regular date on of like seeing her on video chat or anything like that. It's just how she serves you. And she would always talk about like her glorious bloodline and how this was her baby. And I was like, she's not an extension of you. I am not an extension of you. You can't continue to write people's genetic identity out. And yeah, it just was very like, I kind of had this moment of like, she's going to be subjected to, on some minute level, the same sort of talk that I was subjected to. And I'm not having it. And like, my mom would just lose her shit. Like, I was driving, running out of gas, looking for a gas station. And she called me and I was like, I have to call you back in 5 minutes, and hung up because I was using my phone to find the nearest petrol station because I didn't know where I was. And she just sent through just a tirade of just the most horrific stuff you could think of ever saying to your child, anyone, but especially your child. And I just blocked her immediately. And that was 2 years ago. And I never looked back. I was just like, you know what? You're cruel. You're thoughtless at best. Like, I'm not having this in my life. I'm not having you in my daughter's life. And she never even knew I fell pregnant or had Charlie. So that was kind of the end of that. Yeah. So since then I've kind of redefined, you know, it's hard to figure out what you want to do when all you know is exactly what you don't want to be. It's like, all I have is the negative. I'm not going to be anything like her. And I have no, like, straight relationships were always kind of vilified, you know, oh, well, their husband is their master. Oh, you always have to have your own secret, separate money in case he screws you over, as they all inevitably do. And like, it was very misandric conversation around the house. And I was like, I really love my husband. He's my best friend. I trust him implicitly, and everything we have is shared. And I'm not about this narrative of him being some sort of like secret villain or taking my power in some way and like denying the necessity of the masculine energy in a child's life. It's so harmful. Like, they need that. And it kind of plays into traditional gender roles too, where I've found myself, to my surprise, really resonating with like really Christian people, really right-wing people that are like, you know, there are two genders. And I'm like, there are, you know, like, I get it. Like, I'm not saying that people can't feel how they feel, but now having lived this experience of having children and what a traditional family dynamic is, I am a lot more a fan of the traditional gender roles. I am so grateful, so grateful that I get to stay home with our kids and only work when I want to, if I want to, casually here and there. And appreciative of what that burden is for him to be the sole financial provider. And if anything ever happened, it's on him to figure it out, as opposed to feeling trapped because he controls the money. Like, that's not. So it was just really hard to kind of break out of that narrative I had been fed of like, well, being straight is inherently being weak, or, you know, you're going to be like a servant or whatever. So, yeah. That's kind of how I came to be, I guess, a hippie, but not a hippie, like kind of in the middle of like, yeah, I give birth at home and, you know, I'm happy to do all the alternative medicine stuff, but also like, I have no issue being like, yes, we are a totally normal heterosexual couple and there's nothing wrong with that. Like, I don't feel like I need to apologize for that life that I was told was in somehow, like in some way losing, if that makes sense.
If you had to kind of deconstruct a lot of what you were taught from your childhood and kind of find your own way, where do you think, when did you feel like you started listening to that inner compass, like that intuition of finding what you believe and what you want? When did that start after you gave birth to Rachel? Or
there's actually a moment I can pinpoint it exactly. She was a few months old, 3 or 4 months old baby. And she'd gotten quite sick. Maybe she was older. And I had gotten sick and Joe had gotten sick and we were just absolutely down and out. And I was emotional. And my parents had, I'd lived in Australia for like 10 years at this point. My parents had never come over, never made any like attempt to know my life whatsoever here. And I had always said, oh, when I have a baby, that's when I'll finally be on their radar. They'll finally care about something other than themselves. And she was really sick. We're all really sick. And I called Susan, Leanne's partner, who had raised me since I was 3. And I called her mom because I have a half sister who's 10 years younger than me, who unfortunately I don't talk to anymore either. She cut me off after I cut them off because they control her. And when she was born, I started calling Susan mom. And so I called Susan when I was really sick. And I was like, please, please come over. Like, I was crying. And I was like, I actually just need a parent right now. Like, this is so hard for me, like, to see all these other women at the shops with their mothers and to know that, like, I just don't have any support whatsoever. Like, I've got Joe and he's fabulous, but like, that's it. Like, he has a sister who, you know, lived a little bit away from us, but is not like overly maternal and wasn't gonna, you know, come and help and whatever. And that's it. And we didn't really have anyone else. And so I called her crying and I was like, I'm just really low. I'm having a really hard time. I feel really alone and I don't know what to do. And she was like, let me talk to Joe. And she told Joe, take her to a hospital, get her checked into an insane asylum. She's having a mentee bee, get her locked up. She's lost it. And Joe was like, no, I think these are normal feelings and wants that she's having. And the conversation ended, I can't remember how, but it ended. And I didn't hear from her for like a month. And then I messaged her and I was like, hey, what's up? And she was like, oh, are you okay? I was worried, but I figured you would be fine. And I was like, you know what? You know what? I'm going to do this my way. I'm done. Like, I'm done thinking that you guys are going to care or help me in any way. And kind of part and parcel for that, it was like, I had to adhere to these like rules of what they wanted and what was right for them. But then I got absolutely nothing in return. And so that's when I was like, I just threw it all out. I was like, I'm no longer practicing Judaism. I could give two shits. I no longer care about being from Cincinnati, Ohio, American, whatever. Like everything that they had attempted to give me, I just threw it away and was like, I don't want any part of it. And now I have to rewrite my own story, my own family, my own culture, rhythm of life. What is that going to look like? And that was when I was like, maybe I'll base it off the moon. Yeah. Like, I'll do some witchy stuff. Yeah. Libra's in Pluto. So let's have a blue dinner. I don't know. It was random, but I was just grasping at straws. And it's been okay. You know, like we make it work. And I've done a lot of online watching therapy videos of recovering from narcissism abuse. And like I was saying earlier, the things that I thought were like my unique personality traits are actually just an amalgamation of trauma responses. And I was like, okay, I don't want to pass that on, or that's not a healthy reaction, or, oh, this is why I'm reacting this way.
Yeah. So it's like, who are you? Who are you? Because especially with narcissist parents, you only serve them and their narrative and their needs. The awakening journey is finding the authentic self. We're all doing it to some degree, but I just can't imagine what it feels like for you with your upbringing. Did you feel like you knew aspects of who you were? Because the moment of you're on the bed holding your own hand, which brought me to tears, parenting yourself as a young girl. Yeah, my question is, could you feel fragments of your authentic self throughout your childhood, even though you had this narcissist parent or two narcissist parents, whatever, where your only existence was to serve them? That's why they had you through a sperm donor. They needed this human to fulfill themselves.
Yeah. Well, so it's interesting because Beth has said to me, I'm so glad I have you. I'm so glad I'm your mother. I would have never had a child though. I was not that type of lesbian. I was happy as I was. Your mother really wanted to have a baby. And so I was like, okay, I'll go along with it. And so I definitely think, yeah, it was her driving everything as far as like having me to serve her needs. And then with my sister being 10 years younger than me, like I pretty much was just taking care of her as soon as she was born. So I was not only mothering myself and my parents, but then actually mothering my sister, to the extent that when they handed me Rachel in the hospital the first day or two that I was there, they were like, is this your second baby? And I was like, sort of. Yeah. Like, I know what I'm doing, you know, because I just got my sister as a newborn. My mom just went here. She didn't breastfeed her. She went back to work 2 weeks later. And that was it. I was taking care of her like all the time. Whenever, like, I went to school and she went to daycare, but then I'd come home and take care of her.
Is your younger sister a sperm donor baby too?
Oh, 41 minutes. Okay. she is. What had happened was my parents, Susan is a stockbroker. She had invested in a company and the guy had lost all her money. It was a startup and nothing came of it. That's what happens, right? So they were our across the street neighbors. But then they moved to California. They came back to visit and there was a very intense conversation around the dining room table of like, you've lost thousands of dollars of ours, your company's not come to fruition, blah, blah, blah. What are you going to do to make it right? And my mother was like, give me your sperm. I want to have another baby. Give me your sperm. And so this is where it gets wildly inappropriate because I was 9 at the time. They all went out to brunch, continued to talk about this. And then I remember my mom like cornering me in the back of a minivan and being like, what should I do? Should I sleep with him or should Susan use a turkey baster? What are you most comfortable with? And I was like, I am fucking 9 years old. This is wild. I don't know. I don't care. What the hell, right? So anyways, yeah, she ended up falling pregnant that way. I was at a neighbor's house and I remember actually the neighbor's house that I was at, they had been struggling with infertility and she came over and sat down after being inseminated and was just sitting there like, I'm pregnant. I know it. I can feel it. I'm glowing. I'm pregnant. And the woman who'd been struggling with this infertility was just like in tears, like, oh my God. And I'm just sitting there trying to watch Gremlins or whatever they'd put on the TV for me, like trying to dissociate so hard.
Wait, the man that gave your mother the sperm in whatever way, his wife couldn't get pregnant?
No. Different neighbors. They already had two kids. Yeah. No, they already had two kids and they went on to have a third. So she has three half siblings if she ever figures it out, does an ancestry test, whatever. She's met them too, which is really weird. Like they were family friends for a while. And I was just told, like, if you ever tell your sister, I'll break you in half kind of stuff. And I was like, oh, cool. This is awesome. Great. And then she would lie to my parents and say like, oh, Katie told me, I know who it is, and to try to get them to tell her. And then they would be like, oh, did you tell your sister? And I'd be like, no, but how about not having this exist? You know what I mean? Like, how about we just stop? So anyway,
but also it's just crazy though, that they wanted his sperm, but then they gave the baby to you and didn't breastfeed, just...
No. Leanne had my sister to trap Susan further, because Susan used to always tell me, I only really got with your mom because I saw you as this little fragile three-year-old. She was insane. I wanted to raise you. I really wanted to be a mom, and it wasn't happening for me because I didn't want to get pregnant, and the woman I was with was much older. And so I loved your mom, but I wanted to save you. You were the reason I stayed. And I was getting older, and that's when Leanne was like, time to redouble down that contract for 18 more years. And it was the same thing she used to tell Beth, you know, that she would tell Susan, if you step a toe out of line, if you do this, that, and the other, I will take these girls away from you. You will never see them, and blah, blah, blah. And Susan always felt more of a mother to my sister, because that was the one she saw from soup to nuts, if you will, like from conception to... So my mom was never really maternal as such, and she didn't really care. It was just another bargaining chip.
She had children for control, for greater control. That's insane.
Yeah. Yeah. It actually, when I was younger, manifested as me having like a phobia of pregnant women and kind of like hating pregnant women. And I always knew I wanted to have kids. So I just kind of had this like disconnect, I guess you could say, between what I wanted and what I thought. And yeah, and in retrospect, it was like, I wasn't actually afraid of pregnant women. I just hated her. I really hated her when she was pregnant, because she stopped taking all of her medication and she stopped drinking because she didn't want it to affect the baby. But it meant she was absolutely fucking insane. I mean, everything I owned thrown in a garbage bag, moving out of the house every other week, leaving scribbled frantic little notes underneath my pillow for Susan of like, I think this is the hotel we're going to, you know, please come find us. Or, you know, she's really off her rocker this time. It was just so hectic. And then even through my whole pregnancy, Susan was like, oh, wow, you didn't even lose your mind. Like, I thought you would, because your mother did. So I assumed you would. And it was just like, wow.
My question is, what comes up for you in middle of mothering your two, because you're doing it so differently? Do you have like waves of grief, sadness? I don't know. Just what's that like?
It's weird. I guess I wouldn't describe it as jealousy, because like, I'm so happy that they're having this life that I so wanted. And it's not like I'm envious of it or anything like that, but there is like a grief for like what could have been, I guess, but it never could have been, you know, but the idea of it, of that. It's the same thing I felt when I was a little kid and I would look at other kids in normal, happy families and be like, ugh, I wish it was for me. So it's kind of like grief coupled with immense relief of like, oh, this is the life that I have built with them. I have given them a good mother, a healed, healing mother. I have found not just my husband, but an amazing father, like, and seeing what that can actually look like, as opposed to just all this string of negative archetypes of what I was told being a father was, because, you know, I was never going to have it. So they were like, oh, it's awful anyways. You don't want that. Like, it's no good. And neither of them had relationships with their fathers. So it was like, they're useless. You don't need them, you know? I'm just glad that they have good lives.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Where should we wrap this up? I feel like that was actually really
a
good.
A bit of a trauma dump. Sorry.
my God, it's just so fascinating. The conversation of nurture versus nature. The fact that you found such a good man and that you always were oriented towards not hating men when it seems like that was maybe the story in the house. Like, how does that work, right?
Yeah, it was from a very early point, a big point of difference between us, because I would have boyfriends and I would like bring them home and whatever. And my parents would be like, oh, he's ugly. Oh, he's got weird teeth. Oh, he's got bad hair. Oh, you like the weirdest guys. Because I always really liked very nerdy, very intellectual guys. And I didn't really care what they looked like. I just got lucky that Joe was also very handsome. And I was like, whoo. And so it was always just a point for me of just like, well, I don't really care what you think of them, you know? Like, and I have to say, like, I love my daughter. I love her more than anything. But having Charlie, I was like, I'm actually in love with this little man, with this little baby. Like, I can see the beauty in the relationship between the heterosexual woman and her son, as opposed to just purely the villainous, like, oh, you will always be my little mini husband. You will, you know, it's like, no, you won't. I accept that I will be the mother-in-law to someone someday. That's okay, you know? So, no, it's a very interesting, different dynamic. And I think I always kind of saw it as like, not a point of rebellion, but just like a relief in the difference, being like, I am already not like you guys. I'm already finding something different for myself because this is what I want. And I remember yelling at my mom and being like, if you're telling me that blood doesn't matter, right? That Susan is my mother just as much as you are, that love makes a family, then why are you harping on and on and on about me being your genetic daughter, your family, your blood, your whatever? And by the same token, like, I just think that allows for a different relationship with my children where it's like, you are my family, but I don't own you. I'm not possessive of you in the same sort of way. I'm not looking for myself in you. I'm looking to see you emerge.
That's so beautiful. Yeah, I think your story, honestly, what I feel is it's the power of choice. Like, we all have such unique different childhoods and we have different programming and wounds and all these things. But your story just encapsulates the power of co-creation of how you want to live your life, the power of choice, how you want to raise your family, how you want to be as a mom, no matter what happened in your childhood. And I think that's powerful. And thank you so much for sharing such an insane story.
Well, thank you for listening. Yeah.